Good morning. Today is Friday the 19th of November 2021. I am Lynn Sturm. I have been given the privilege of interviewing Colin Trevelyan of Mangere Territory. Over to you, Colin.
Okay. I got the property which originally was Climate and Food Research Station. Okay. So I was born in Waipakurau in 1947 and my parents were in Waipakurau. My grandfather was one of the first doctors in Waipakurau Hospital in 1898 or something. And he had a medical business across the road from the hospital. It was the older house from the main door of the hospital. But he died in 1957, about during the war. And I lived in Waipakurau and I had many sort of jobs, like paper run and mowing lawns and that. And I had one plan from when I was about 10 years old that I would be a millionaire by the time I retired. Every penny you ever get, any money you ever get, you save one third to pay for things. You invest one third and one third you have to spend. And from when I was doing my paper run, I'd do the same thing. You know, I still even do it now, but it's a bit different now. Okay, I've been around the world 140 times. I was working in Waipakurau, I was a paper boy, then I was working before school down at Mr. Stewart's in Ford Road, helping milk cows. And then I'd go to the college, and then after school I was working at Hume's Pipe Company until about 5:30, then I go up to milk the cows again with Mr. Stewart for the night. And then next day the same thing. So it was quite handy. Oh, and then at the same time, just after I left school, I got a job in the Waipak Power Board. And I was also working for Wendy Studios as a wedding photographer, taking photos and that. So that was a very handy job because I got one of the first really posh sports cars in Waipakurau. You probably know the car, the Daimler V8, Daimler Dart I had. And that was very good for picking up young ladies, especially at weddings and everything else, when I was doing the photos. Many bridesmaids had the ride home in the car to the wedding or not. Between Hume's Pipe Company and Milk and Bee Cows and everything else. So I worked in the Waipak Power Board up until 1969, and then I decided to go overseas. So I bought a ticket to Australia on a ship. We were going from Wellington. So I went down to Wellington, got on the ship, and went over to Australia, and then I got a job on the ship and went to South Africa. I was meant to go to England, but I got drunk in South Africa, and so the ship left without me. It didn't matter. So I went up to the electricity supply thing in Johannesburg, out of Germiston, and I went in and said that I knew everything about power and everything. They said, okay, what have you done? And I said, work for the Waipakurau Power Board. And they said, that's okay, well, you can go out and build power pylons through to the goldfields in Bloemfontein. Oh, I know everything about that. Never even seen one. I saw one out of Ongle once. So I had a Dutch crane driver and a Dutch digger driver, and the rest of them were native crew. We went out and dug holes and built power pylons through to the goldfields and lived out in the jungle and had about, I think it was a weekend off here, three weekends. The third weekend would work. But it was a lot of fun out in the bush in the towns that were there then. The apartheid was in full swing and it was a very good time for some people there. And so I did that for about 9 months or so, and then I bought a old Mazda pickup truck and I took a Mapedi and a Zulu guy, the two of them, had a ride in the back of the truck until we crossed the border up the top, and then they were allowed in the cab and that, and then we travelled all over Africa, living in native villages, just living with the natives, so there was for about 6 months, a year or so. And then I eventually got back to Cape Town and got a job on a boat, and the boat was meant to come to New Zealand, but we went by America, and I never had a visa or nothing, so I got put in the compound there. They took half the money off you to put you on a plane to fly you out, and so for my, I think it was $27 they took off me because I only had 56, and then they flew to London. They put me on, I think it was Oriental Express or something, then one of those cheap airlines that were operating then, and I was dropped off in London. So So I moved into the underground with my sleeping bag and went and got a job with Harrods at an agency and found out that I could go into the front door, walk through the shop and go to where I was meant to be working down the bottom, walk up the stairs, walk out the shop, never come back until 5 o'clock at night when I went and clocked my card and I never did a day's work in the whole time. They got paid the money for it every week. The agency didn't mind, they were taking 20% or something off of it. And I just lived a good life around London and everything else. Then I decided to travel across Europe. So I learned very quickly that I went for about 9 months or so and it cost me £100 for food, travel and everything. And I went to about 20 countries. The first thing I learned was when you get on the train, you always have your money in American dollars because guards could never take foreign money. He had to take only the money for their country. So he'd come along and say, ticket, and you say, I'll buy a ticket. And he'd tell you how much, and say, show him $10 American. You can't take foreign money. I said, but nothing else. You have to get off at the next station and change it and say, of course you get off with your bag and let that train go because you're going to get on the next one for nothing and you might get another 200 more. And I lived in a lot of parks because at night time you make sure you get picked up. You go and sleep in the park, maybe get a bit drunk and sleep in the park, but always sleep near the gate because when the police come and throw you in the paddy wagon, you get to the jail. If you get in the van first and get to the jail, well, then you can get the bunk beside the cell doors because not enough bunks for everybody. Plus, in the morning, if you're beside the door, you can get out because you've only got a little bit of breakfast. So you get a good feed before they throw you out into the outskirts of the town and drop you off and tell you to get out of their city. So you could travel. I travelled all over Europe and everything else for very little, costing me nothing at all for travel, food or anything else. Plus you learned to know all the supermarkets that had free samples and everything else all over Europe and that. Then I eventually got back to England and I went berry picking first up in Northern England and I was hitchhiking around. Then I went up to Scotland and got a job with Grosbeater on Invercord Estate, which is just down the road from Balmoral. But Invercord is about 3 or 4 kilometres from the town. So we would go every night. We'd have to go over there and get drunk. We didn't have enough money to drink every night. And so we talked to the Queen Mother because she'd be fishing down the river and everything else. Because then there was no guard. They didn't have no guards or nothing. She would be out there fishing by herself. But then we hitchhiked into Aberdeen. We went down to the wharf to find a job. We went into an oil company and he said, we want a job. It's a roustabout or something. And he said, are you single? And he said, yep. There was me and me mate. And he said, get out to the airport by 4 o'clock. There's a plane coming up from France. You're flying to Norway. Then you're going on a helicopter. You're going about 200 or 300 miles above the Arctic Circle. You'll be on to Drillmaster 83 drilling rig. He said, you'll arrive out there about midnight, 1 o'clock in the morning. You'll start work immediately because you're doing that shift. And your job will be with the steam guns cleaning the ice off for the guys to work. So that was very good. We got out there. We started on the Thursday night, but on the Saturday night, the diving bell went down and the weight broke off and it shot to the surface and the 4 guys inside were blown to bits and killed. So being the roustabouts, we had to get in with a rubbish bag and get ourselves a body each. The other 2 guys that were roustabouts quit, and so me and me mate, we got 2 bags of bits. And we were promoted on the Monday to roughnecks. We only took 4 or 5 days to get to be roughnecks. We used to do 2 weeks on, 2 weeks off, and then flown back to Aberdeen where we had signed on. I used to go back to Aberdeen and then I would wait until the rest of the crew went out of the airport. Then I'd go over and sign myself up to another oil company and go out and work with them for a couple of weeks. Come back and do the same thing, go back to my old company so I could make the money with 2 jobs. After about 3 months or so, the derrickman fell out of the derrick and spattered all over the floor. They wanted to carry on drilling, so who knows how to work the derrick? I do. Get up there, put a belt on, would you? Don't be like him, spattered all over the place. You guys, clean them up, clean the deck up. Why don't get up? We've got work to do. Hurry up, chop, chop. So we carried on drilling, so I got promoted up to derrickman then. And I worked there for a few months more, and then I went down to Iraq as an assistant driller and worked my way up from there. In the finish, I've worked in about 52 countries of it. But once I went to Iraq, I started doing month on, month off. So that's how I would fly back to New Zealand for month off and then fly back. But many of the months that I'd come back to New Zealand, I'd come back for a week, mow the lawn, take Anne out for dinner a few times. Then I'd just say, I'll be back shortly. I'm just going over to America. So I'd go over to Houston and do a course for a week or something. I'd say, I'll be back in a week. Come back in a week and I'd Nova Lords take me out a few more times, then I might have to go to Australia and do another course for a week. I said, I'll be back shortly before I go away again, so I'd come back home, Nova Lord again, take me out a few more times, then I would go back over to Europe or Africa or somewhere, which week I was on, or Japan or somewhere, and do another month. Then I worked my way up to a company, and from about 1982, I think, I was in charge of my first lot of rigs as a tool pusher. So that was very good. But it was very well paid, because I could come back for my month off, and I would have enough money to buy a house. I would get my push bike out and ride around Tijuana and say, I think I'll buy that house. So I would go home and I'd write a letter and say, if you cash this cheque and sign this bit of paper for sale of your house is sold, cash the cheque, you've sold your house, be out in 30 days, thank you very much. And at one stage I owned about 12, 15 houses out there, because they were only about $17,000 to $40,000 each then. And so I'd buy up many, many houses, many houses. And not only there, I bought them in Napier and I bought them in Waipuk. At one stage there was about six or seven in Waipuk. Then just carried on from there. I got my first camera to start my museum off on the 10th of April 1959, 10:30 in the morning. It's out there behind the door. Mrs. Lunt up in Prongau Road lived across from us, and she bought the camera over and gave it to me for me 10th birthday, because her husband had died a couple of months before. I knew her pretty well, I mowed her lawn too. So she came over and gave me this camera for my birthday. And that's a camera that's still out there. That was the start of collecting cameras.
So how many do you own now?
I don't know, about 6,000 or 7,000. It's one of the biggest collections in the world. Before COVID, I had more visitors, because it's never advertised.
That's word of mouth.
So I get more people. I used to get about the same number of people from overseas. People would fly from Belgium and France for the day just to play with cameras, see some particular cameras. Three doctors from Singapore had nothing to do, so they flew over here and played with cameras for the day and flew back at night. One guy flew from Poland to London to Los Angeles all night to New Zealand, got to Auckland, you know, half past six or something in the morning, flew down to Napier, got a rental car, come out here, saw the cameras he wanted to, played with, I give him some lunch. And then he took the rental car back to the thing, flew back up to Auckland at 4 o'clock, caught the 6 o'clock flight back to Los Angeles, back to Europe. Just to see some cameras that he wanted. But the big problem now is probably in the last 2.5 months I've had over 1,000 cameras come in. Even yesterday afternoon I got an email, a guy's got 8 trailer loads of cameras and photographic gear he wants to bring down. Because the problem is that in New Zealand cameras are not a big collectible item. The second-hand shops don't want them. Quite the hospital shop, you know, the shops in town. I used to put them in a box and give them to the kids down the bottom, but they're not allowed to now under health and safety, because small kids can eat those little batteries in there. That kid in Sydney did swallow one of those batteries. And they can get cut with the glass, so they're not allowed to do that now. So they save all the cameras up, because they get a lot from the States, in the box up top and on the shelf, and they give me a ring every month or 2 months, and I go and give them a donation, and they say, take the cameras, go. Because if they don't, they end up in the landfill. And that's what the problem is with these big collections I've been getting. The guys have had camera shops up in Auckland and that sort of stuff. But now they're all pretty elderly and they're moving into, you know, retirement villages. And they've got no storage space. They go to a second-hand shop and say, would you buy, or you could have a truckload of cameras. They said, we've got no room for them. We can't sell them. And the auction rooms get nothing for them. They might get $10 or $20, but the amount of work they've got to go in to sell them, it's not. But I go out and sometimes I come back. So I went over with my mate, we got 3 Queens ships for 4 or 5 months around the top of Europe and that sort of thing. We met a lady friend in town one day. I didn't know her. I met her the first time. I said, what do you do? She said, oh, just sell me business. I said, oh, do you like tigers? And she said, why? So I want to come to India, chase some tigers on the elephants. So we did. We went across India for 3 weeks. One day when I opened the museum down in Waipagurau, it was quite funny. I went out to the bank one day. I'd got it all rigged up and everything done. You know, got all the cases and the cameras all set up and everything. But as was said before, the rates went up that high. And so I offered it to the council. I went to the council and said, I'll donate the whole museum down there with the cameras, the cases. And they didn't want it. They said, no, we've got a museum in Waipa with it. Cost the ratepayers a lot of money to keep it. we don't want it, we'd have to pay somebody to look after, they would know nothing about it, and then we'd have to pay maintenance on the building. So no, we don't want it, thank you very much. And so I packed the whole lot up and sold the building. But the elderly people, like, they have these big collections, and, you know, they've saved up over the years for all sorts of things. So they just want to get rid of them somewhere. So sometimes I get these boxes on my veranda, but no name or nothing, full of cameras that come from all over the place. That's okay. With most things, if you're doing something, you've got to find out every single thing about them and all that. So like a guy come in here one day, he come in a camper van and he was travelling around New Zealand. And I always rave on about Leica and Litz and that. And we like a room there. And so he went down to South Island for 2 months. And then, I think it was 2 or 3 months after, I got a phone call and he said, Colin, I was in your museum a few months ago. He said, I was in a camper van going down the South Island. He said, that name you want, there's a guy got an old camera with that name on it, a little silver plate with that name Leica, Litz on it. And it's in a garage sale between Bluffton and Invercargill. You might still have it, I'll give you his number. I retired in 1999.
How old were you then?
Just on 50. That lasted about 6 weeks. I got that many phone calls and things. I went back as a consultant for oil companies. I went into Russia and all over Russia and Angola, Congo and Cameroon. Did all those places. But I was working on a day rate then as a consultant, so I was quite well paid. But I think that, you know, like when the fires were between Kuwait and Iraq during the war, well, they had on TV, they were putting the fires out, you know, they had a picture on the news, they put another fire out. It was nothing that was like that at all. It was very good because, I mean, I was getting paid at that time about $3,000 a day to work with Red Adair there, putting out those fires. And so do you think we put them out? Well, the one for the camera was put out, but we kept them going for 9 months. Even the coffee boy was being paid $500 a day. So it's quite ridiculous. A lot of stuff you see on the news. It's the same as another thing that I got. The gorillas of the mist, you know, in Cameroon. You know, they're always going on about gorillas in the mist. I worked in Cameroon below that mountain. They never ever once said that that's the national food. We'll eat the gorillas. You go down the market, you can eat gorilla heads and paws and everything else. They sell them in the market. You know, as meat. But they were doing the big begging trip for gorillas in the mist. And it's the same as in the Congo and that sort of place, where they save the elephants, save the elephants from all the poachers. You've got to get rid of the elephants, because there's that blinking many of them. They're the ones who are doing all the damage, getting food, breaking up the forest, the villages and everything. And it's people like Helen Clark that goes over there and watches with the Kenya Prime Minister when she was in the United Nations. Kenyan Prime Minister burned $4 million worth of elephant tusks and then turns around and gives them $2 million or something for the schools. Why didn't he go and sell all those elephant tusks instead of just burn them up and put a big show on for TV? Yeah. So anyway, I got to Libya and I was looking after a big Canadian company in Gaddafi and got up and went stupid and blew up my rigs, and so I decided to retire again. And ever since then, Anne and I did four or five trips. Before, you used to go 4 or 5 trips a year down the canals and all of Europe and all that. We had to see the pandas, do all those things. So we had a pretty good time.
So where's your favourite place in the world?
Oh, anywhere, the whole lot. Well, Africa's all right. New York's pretty good. I took Anne's sister and we went over to New York to the marathon. We went twice, actually. Anne didn't go in it, but her sister went. She was 17, she went in it. So I shouted her a trip over there to go in the marathon. That was about 2013, yeah. And then we did a lot of trips down with APT down the canal boats from, you know, Paris down to Nice and all those places and down the Danube. And otherwise, not much else. One day, about 1980s, Anne said, Shane, her son was going to start college. I said, oh, well, why didn't he go to college in Denver? And she said, why Denver? And I said, because there's a whole row of shops for sale. I'll go and buy them. There's a few houses, I'll go and buy the whole lot, and you can live down there and run a few shops, and he can go to school there. So that's what we did. And then I carried on working on the rig. I'd come home for a month, eat all the ice cream, and then go back again. And so he was running the shops down there. That we got very well. You can't do very much now, but you can't travel or anything. Otherwise, I would have been over in London now, because last Sunday was London to Brighton Run, or 2 weeks ago. It's always the first Sunday in November. I would have been over there for that. When you could travel, I used to go over to it, but now you can't do that or anything.
And what plans for future?
Well, I don't know. I'm going to travel. My mate worked on the oil rig too, and he made a lot of money. He had a big house over in Perth, but he sold all that. I got hold of him now. And I said, where are you? Because I can't come and visit you. He said, no. He said, I'm in Scotland. He said, my wife's parents were a bit sick, and so I come over. So I bought a castle. And I've got 8 posh bedrooms and wedding venue with currants and everything else up the back of Oban on the west coast of Scotland. And he's got his own private plane. He's got a 1957 Tiger Moth type plane, that type of plane, but much powerful. He does all the air shows. So he said, as soon as all these restrictions and everything, come over and I'll pick you up. We've got a lot of air shows to do in Europe and play around. So I said, I'm not sleeping in the dungeon on the castle. He said, no, we might let you have a room. Yeah. And I'm trying to work out what I'm going to do with this museum. Because I've got no family, nothing. But I've had a few offers. Well, I've talked to a few people over in London and China. Someone comes along. Good. But a young guy came down the other day and he's interested in old cars. So I might sell him some old cars. I've got rid of half a dozen cars or so in the last few years. Still got 20 that are...
Colin, what about the bits and pieces you got from aerial mapping?
Oh, yeah, I've got the whole lot. Well, I'm actually going this afternoon because Napier Aviation, with the Napier Club, they are wanting to start a museum of flying in Hawke's Bay. And they actually have their meetings on Friday afternoon from 2 o'clock to 5 o'clock. So I went last Friday. There's only about 5 at the minute. But they said, more will come along. So I go to them because I'll eventually end up with it all in their museum. But I own the hangars and everything. So. Well, you see, it was a camera that I particularly wanted because, you see, aerial mapping, Pete Van Ass died in about the 90s or something, and then his son took over from, you know, out at Havilah. His wife runs Duett House. Well, he died about 6 months ago. But in 1998, and from then on, he got to be chairman of aerial mapping. Well, it sort of went, because he was not into electronics and digital stuff. And so one of the main reasons why it went under was in 2004, he bought a big camera for the planes for cost $1.4 million. And it was a very good camera. It was made by Leica. And it took 23 centimeter photos and this huge roll of film to take 500 photos. That's why in Hastings they had a big setup there to develop the film. Well, in 2007, that complete film was never made anymore in the whole world. And so that was sort of one of the reasons why aerial mapping went down and went into liquidation, because they'd spent all the money on doing film photography for surveys, but that was being finished because they didn't need all those places. They could have done digital stuff with drones and everything. Drones were taking over. So the camera, what was in the paper, they were selling the hangars liquidation sale, was by tender. So I put a tender in for the camera of $3,000. And I put a tender in to buy the hangars for about $800,000, I think, something like that. It was around that mark. But I didn't get it. Didn't get any of it. So then, 2 years later, nobody got it. And so 2 years later, they put it all up again. I put in for the hangars, but only put in half the price that I put in the first time. And I got the whole lot. And then about a month or so, it was, I think afterwards, I got a phone call from Price Waterhouse, because they were the ones that were the liquidators. And they said, Colin, about a couple of years ago, you put in a price $3,000 to buy a camera. How much do you put in for it now? I said, okay, listen carefully. You've got 1 minute. I'll give you $100 for 1 minute. And he said, 60 seconds. And he said, what happens after 60 seconds? I said, you'll know in about 40 seconds time because you're wasting time. Do you want the $100 for the camera or not? He said, no, I can't make that decision. I said, you better hurry up. You've only got about 10 and 15 seconds left. And I said, righto, time's up. The camera's mine now. I have the whole lot for nothing. He said, how do you come by that? And I said, well, you didn't accept $100. And he said, no. And I said, well, where is the camera? He said, it's stored in the hangars at Bridge Park. I said, who owns the hangars in Bridge Park? He said, I don't know. I said, well, look it up. He said, oh, some company owns it, some trust. And I said, oh, it wouldn't be Rangoon Trust, would it? And he said, yeah. And I said, I own Rangoon Trust. I said, oh, God, fancy your camera being in my hangers. Now, I said, if you read down in that contract, I bought all those hangers, and if you read in there, it was $500 a month for storage. I said, so you owe me $3,500 plus GST for storage. I'll send you a bill, and I'll keep the camera. I sent him a bill for $3,700 or something, and sure enough, they paid it. And he said, I've got to take the camera out. And I said, don't be stupid, it's 2 o'clock. And he said, well, I said, I'm shutting the doors and they're being locked up in about 1 hour's time. I said, have you got a forklift and a truck? The camera weighs over 600 pounds. It takes up a whole half a container. You can never get it out in an hour. I said, you can't beat me out there to shut the doors. Sure enough, that's what I did. That's how I got the camera. So the camera's out of the container out there. It's huge. So I've got the complete series of all of their cameras. But I was very lucky I was going through, because I got a lot of the paperwork to when they sold in Hastings, because I knew all the old guys that had worked for them, like the Havelock Mayor. I knew them all, and they used to bring me out cameras and all the information, tell me all about it. I've got a whole sort of little part down there just on area mapping, in the area mapping room. I'd got all this information. I was going through it only 2 weeks ago, and I'd got the Otolite, and I found the booklet. It's only a small booklet, but it's all about Sir Edmund Hillary when he went across the Antarctic in 1957, and here he has been presented with the theodolite that I've got, and it's a photo of him accepting the theodolite and the whole story of him going right across the Antarctic and the Ferguson tractors. A lot of that sort of stuff in the museum here.
And where did you get all the hospital stuff that you've got?
Ah, well, I get a lot of the hospital stuff I did, because hospitals are all out of government, and that's stupid. So they go and buy all this gear, you see, and so what happens is, you know, when they buy microscopes, they go and buy new ones, but they never sell the old stuff. They go and stick it in the storeroom. Then they go and buy more new stuff, and they stick the other stuff in the storeroom. And what happens eventually is the storeroom gets full. So the government, they go and call in the dump to go to the recycling. They never do anything, or else, once they get hold of them, I know that I want it, they send it to me. So I've got all sorts of stuff from Nelson Hospital, from Auckland Hospital, and I get all these microscopes and all that sort of stuff. They send it to me. Because you see, now it's all digital. They can't use all this old stuff, you know, because all schools used to have science classes when you had a microscope and looked down. They've all finished now. Schools have a cell phone or a computer screen where you press a button and it comes up. So that's where a lot of it came from. It's like when they got rid of the White Oak Hospital. All that stuff went to the landfill and just ground up and dumped. You never see them advertising old microscopes. Even most recently one I've got is from, what's the name of the hospital in Hastings, the private one?
Royston.
Well, a lady doctor came out one Sunday afternoon. She said, oh, Colin, I've got something in the car for you. And she'd given me three complete units, you know, the cancer one where they go up your ear and it takes the cancer out, all the screens, everything. They cost hundreds of thousands of dollars, these complete units. She said, there's all the cameras with them and the tubes, everything works. And I said, well, why are you giving it to me? And she said, because people pay a huge amount of money to go to hospital and have this sort of stuff at our hospital, or like any private hospital. But she said, this stuff is 15 years old, even though it works good for us if we're just here. We can't send their stuff to London or Harley Street to the specialists overseas because they've got the latest and greatest gear. And all of this scientific gear, the cards inside, you know, that run them, are good for 5 years. After 5 years, you have to renew the whole. Nothing lasts longer than 5 years because they want to get a results and diagnosis from some professor. He can't read the information on the computers. That's why they have to keep up to date all the time with all the newest stuff. Because even big companies like Leica, up until 2000, they were all film cameras. They were good. After that, they started on digital cameras. Now, digital cameras, they are never ever going to be real collector's items because the batteries are changed from every model. And so the battery charges, and you can't go and use a battery in an old one. So if you've got a 10-year-old digital camera, it's useless. It's only on show, it can never be used. And even Leica, I mean, you have a 5-year warranty when you buy a new Leica, costing you a fortune. Now, if that camera breaks in that 5 years, they don't fix it. They give you a brand new model. Canon and all the big camera companies now, there's no more repair facilities, they've finished. Mm. They're all giving brand new stuff. No company could hold all the little circuit boards and everything to go in them. They would have to store them up, what, maybe to repair one camera or something. So that's what's happening. So digital ones are never going to be really big collectibles. They're just going to be show collectibles. Where the old film ones can still use them. Like that one I was telling you about, that the guy that I got from Bluff, that I rang the guy up and he said, you got this old camera? And I said, give me $200 if you send it up to me. But I need to get it quite quick. This was in 2002 or something. So he sent it up and I set it all up. And I checked up on all the history and it had actually come to New Zealand in 1874 on the sailing ships, and it was used down in Dunedin when they were setting up the hospitals. It's in there, a microscopic camera for photographing small things onto a big glass plate. So I got all the history that I could find about it. So then I went off to London. I had to get a visa to go down to Congo. So I was in London for 4 days and I went to the big shop in London where you've got to go through the alley. You've got to press the buzzer and you've got a little peephole and you look through, and if you've got to like a camera around your neck or he knows you, you can come in the shop. It's between Pall Mall and Trafalgar. If you're not, you can't go in. You won't let you into the shop. There's too much valuable stuff in there. But I knew him, so I got into the shop and I said to him, have you got any books about the 1874 10x12 glass plate cameras that were used for medical purposes? And he said, no, there's no such thing. The best is 1888. I said, no, 1874. I've got it here. I said, have a look at this photo. He said, oh, God, where'd you get that? I said, I've got it, actually. And he said, what do you mean you've got it? And I said, I've got it. It's a photo of my camera setup. And he said, oh, I'll give you £50,000 for the photo, and next time you come over here, you bring the camera over and give it to me. I said, no, that's all right. He said, how long are you in London for? And I said, 4 days, I'm leaving on Saturday. He said, come and see me Friday. He said, I'll have a deal for you. I said, I'll come and see you, but I don't know. So I went to see him on Friday. He said, okay, $750,000 New Zealand dollars I'll give you. That's equal to about £400,000. I'll give you $50,000 now and I'll give you the rest when you bring the camera over. Because he knew I was going back and forth. I said, no. And he said, okay, got you $1 million. I've got actually $1,150,000. $150,000 commission for me, 15%, and you get $1 million. And I said, no. What happens if I get up in the morning and I want to go over there and play with my camera and it's not there? He said, well, you don't do that. I said, of course I do. What else am I going to do? I said, no, I don't need to sell it, so I'll keep it. I'll keep you in mind if I ever decide to get rid of it or something. But that's why it's still sitting in there. But, you know, it's what somebody wants to pay for it, if somebody wants it. But being the only one in the world, a lot of people want it. In 2013, Leica 35mm cameras was 100 years old. And so Leica in Germany picked 100 people around the world that collected Leica cameras, and they flew us to Germany, paid for our airfares, give us a week in Germany with everything. We'd go and get in a taxi, Leica paid. You would go and have a bottle of champagne, it was $200, didn't matter, like a pay. The whole town was free for 1 week, everything, like a pay. They had a school down in South America that they were sponsoring for musical instruments, so they flew the whole music class up to provide music for this week and that sort of thing. So I went over to it, I was one of the 100, went to all the stuff they had on. Then I was invited down on the Tuesday to go through their museum. They showed me through and I said, you've really got a lot of shit in there. I've got more than you have. He said, we know what you've got. He said, we'll get it off you one day. I said, you could get it now if you've got enough zeros. But the thing is that, you see, Leica's a huge company and it keeps being taken over by new people every time. And every time they take over, the first thing they do is sell the stuff out to the museum for huge amounts of money. So they had an auction when I was over there and they sold 100 items. But the big buyers now are young Chinese and young Russians. Mm-hmm. They've got absolutely unlimited amount of money. Because in New Zealand, teenagers get a flat or something and they want to buy a car. That's usually their first thing, they want to buy a car. Well, that doesn't happen over in China because they're living in these small apartments or something. They've got nowhere to keep a car and they wouldn't want a car in the Russians. So they don't spend money on cars. They spend their money on watches and cameras. Those are the two big things. So I was sitting beside this young Chinese guy, and he would only be about 28. And in half an hour, he'd spent over $3 million, and he was non-stop. He was still spending up large, going through everything. But the cheapest thing was a piece of A4 paper, the size of that, with an advertisement of a 1929 Lexus Camry. That was the cheapest thing in the whole auction. That went for $5,000 plus the commissions for one sheet of paper. But I've got in there, I can show you, on the wall. In 1920, there was a Leica camera coming out, number 122, okay? In 1988, an American guy wrote me a letter and told me I was a prospective buyer, and he had Leica number 122. Would I like to buy it for $150,000? That was $300,000 New Zealand then. So I was going over to school at Houston, so I went and played with the camera and thought, if I buy this and Anne finds out that I've spent $300,000 on a camera, she won't be very happy. But she wouldn't know, would she? But nah, I didn't buy it. Didn't buy it, but I kept the letter. 12th of March, not this year, but last year, Leica number 122. You might have seen it on TV3 at 5 News, and it was going on at 11 o'clock at night. Leica number 22 had hit the world record for a price. Guess how much it sold for? $10.85 million, or $4 million plus commissions, which are about $6 million. I've got the letter and the newspaper cutting on the 12th of March. But it's silly little things like, see that Negro doll up there? She's a Barbie doll. On there's a newspaper cutting over there, and she's in the middle winning the gold medal for America in the games. What was the name of the city in America where they had him in 1996? Anyway, she won the medal. So Barbie made those Barbie dolls and they sold them at the Games Village and at the airport for 2 weeks only, that's all. And so I bought it, she was $15.99, and I bought it back and gave it to Anne to give to somebody or something. But Anne didn't give it away to anything else. So then in 2000, I was over there in Houston. I went to the Barbie doll shop because I bought two winter Barbie dolls. I said to the lady, you got any more of a Negroes from the 96 game which won the gold medal? She said, no, but if you had one in a box, it's not ripped open, it's not torn open or nothing, and not damaged, I'll give you $15,000 for it. I said, oh, I do have one of those. It's not here. But you've got to keep them in. She said, why are they so good? Because they only sold for 2 weeks. Guys bought them, took them home to their daughters or their grandkids, and they wound them up a few times, and she threw her leg up in the air. She threw it two or three times. And about the 10th time, she'd throw it over here, and she'd land in the rubbish tin, and that's where she'd end up, never to be seen. And that lady would tell me, I've never seen a kid that's been given a Barbie doll carefully undo all the staples and open the box and carefully take it out and unwind the bit of wire holding. It's always rip it out to wind it up. That's what happened to them. But these Swatch watches, 1996 was 100 years of the Olympic Games. So they brought out this set of watches commemorating the cities for 100 years. There's 9 watches in the box. They brought out 30,000 sets worldwide. That was in 1990, 3 years before the Games. Then 2 years before the Games, they brought out this set. They brought out 30,000 sets of those, this set commemorating people over 100 years. But they only brought out 20,000 sets worldwide. Now that one's events. This is people. 1 year before the Games, they brought out that set. There's only 10,000 sets worldwide. So there's 30,000 sets, 20,000 sets, 10,000 sets. Then during the 1996 Games, they brought out gold watch, silver watch, bronze watch made of Olympic medals. But they only made 276 gold watches because there was only 276 medals in the Games. So that's all they made. There was a few more silver ones and bronze ones, but they were team events. So, only 276 complete sets you can get in the world. I had gone to the shipyard in 96 in Singapore, and so I rang up Anne and said, ring up Swatch in Auckland and tell them I want a set of gold, silver and bronze watch. So she rang me and she called me back in Singapore. She said, they said, there's none coming to New Zealand. There's none assigned. They've all gone, finished. And I said, but I want one. She said, you can't have everything you want. And I said, you want a bet? Okay, that's all right. I'll be home in a couple of weeks. So what I did was I thought, now, how am I going to get that gold, silver and bronze watch? I know. In 1977, I was working in Burma on an oil rig there, and I was a driller on the rig. And the big boss of the oil company come over to Burma, and then you were allowed to drink on the thing. So he bought a lot of the wine, because they own wine companies, wine in France, and he brought that onto the rig. And so we had a big party for about 2 or 3 days while we were working. There had been an oil rig that had gone for another company and was drilling in the bay out of Burma, and it had struck gas and blown up and sunk. And so we had the job of drilling to the gas line and pump in mud and cut off the gas, and hopefully the rig might come up again. They thought I could bring it back up again, but it didn't work. Anyway, so he came over and said, I know what I do. So this was in 1996 when the games comes on. He still owned the company. They had 486 oil rigs all over the world. So I sent him an email. I said, you don't know me, but about 20 years ago, I got drunk with you in Burma. I was a full pusher on the rig when you come over to Burma. Remember the Caltex one that was blown up? I said, would you get hold of the guy that owns Omega watches in Switzerland? Because Omega owned Swatch. And would you get hold of the owner and tell him that I would like to get a gold, silver and bronze watch of the Olympic game, because I've got all the other sets. And it's really your fault that I've got them, because if you hadn't given me a job, I wouldn't have been able to buy these in Dubai, Abu Dhabi. I wouldn't be able to buy them in the other places. So could you see if you can get me the other set? And he did. I had to pay for them, but he got me the set. He got hold of the guys that run Omega, and I got it direct from the big boss of Omega. Then Bennett got home and said to me, there's a big parcel arrived for you. I said, oh, God, fancy that. Sure enough, it was gold, silver and bronze watch.
Sure wasn't Father Christmas.
It's the same, but this is 360 pounds of solid teak. About 2015, we went for a trip to China to see the panda bears. So we went over, we were on the Great Wall, and then we went down to the jade factory in China to buy lunch, because it was included in the tour. So we went for lunch, and when we went in, Nan said, look at that warrior. She said, you want to get one of those to guard your place. So anyway, we go up for lunch, and I said to her, so I've got to go down and find the lure. I didn't see it when I was coming in. I'll be a while, but I've got to go and find it. So I went down and negotiated, and I bought this. But it was going to take 12, 15 weeks to come. Dad always told me that, because he had to be shipped, you know, on the course of the shipping line. So that was okay. So I go down, and that warrior, he's gone. I said, what do you mean gone? He said, that warrior I saw when we come in. I said, oh, that stone thing. Oh, some idiot must have come and bought it or something. So we got on a bus and go. We were home for a week, and then we went for a trip down to South Island for 2 weeks. And then we come back for a week, and it was getting autumn. She said, go on, let's go over to Canada and have a look at the trees. So we flew over to Canada. We got on a tour to go across Canada by train. And then we were going to come back to Vancouver, and then going to Alaska to see the polar bears. But when we were on the train at night, she wasn't very well. She wasn't very good at all. So I went online and I bought some tickets to fly home. So that was okay. When we got to Vancouver to catch the boat, we got off the train and the bus was there, and we get our bags and I walk over towards taxi. She said, the bus is here. I said, no, we're not going on the bus. Oh, I forgot to tell you, we're going home. This is our taxi, we're going to the airport. She said, oh, okay, that's all right. Because I was a bit worried about going to Alaska, because if I got sick on the boat, then I'd have to have a medevac and everything. She said, so I'm quite happy to come home. She was only home for about 3 weeks, and then she went into hospice, and she had cancer bad. And so they give her a week, 10 days or something to live. Well, she went in the hospice for about 4 days. The big box arrived with the warrior in. So I went to the hospice in Hastings. I said, look, if I pay for couple of doctors and an ambulance and that, could you bring Anne out for lunch, just for a short time? And they said, oh, if the doctors say she's well enough to come out. I said, well, I've got it all arranged. You give her movable beds. You can come in and we're going to have the van back up and move the bed in here. We set up these tables and these Chinese things, and I'd invited 10 people to come for Chinese lunch, and they each to bring something Chinese. And then the deal was that we were going to have a competition after had seen what was in the big box. So they bring me in here, and we had all the table set up Chinese style. And she said, "What is this for?" I said, "Oh, just a friend to have a lunch." And she said, "Why Chinese?" I said, "Oh, we've got a special visitor." And I'd already unpacked them, had a sheet over top of them standing here. And she said, "What a special visitor." And I pulled the sheet off, said, "Here, this guy, he wants to meet you again." She said, "That's the warrior." Anyway, so got away. And I said, "Oh, now we're going to have a naming competition, because he hasn't got a name yet. So everyone's going to put a name in the thing. I'll draw the name out. So you write a name on a bit of paper. Here's a bit of paper." So I knew which was her bit of paper. So they put the names in. We drew it out. I said, "Oh, this one here is one." When I pulled it out, and it's now General Jin Singh of Exmoor, because this is known as Exmoor. So this is General Jin Singh of Exmoor. He's 360 pounds of jade. So she was really happy. And then she died 4 days later. So she saw the warrior. Yes.
The other thing before I forget, that book that belonged to this ship.
Oh, the book on HMS New Zealand. Yeah. It was at Peter Circuit's place. And his son had come up with the photo with the sword and told me he had a sword, so I went down to get the sword. And he asked if I'd throw that old book over there into the skip on the way out. So I kept it. And I had a look, and there were swords about a ship, and there was about HMS New Zealand. I'll show you the book. Peter Circuit's other son was in the Air Force during the war. And from when he went in, started off as a cadet, he made a book like this. It wasn't as big and thick as this, and it was chucked in the dump before I got to know about it. Had all the photos of the training of the plane, Art Deco in Napier. I went to see them and I said, "I've got an idea." I said, "I've got about 30 or 40 so far old photographs of Napier, Hastings, White Buck, Tiati, and that from 1920s, 30s, and 40s. And I've got them all enlarged to 5x7 black and white photos. What I'm going to do is I'm going to go to Woodford House, get hold of the headmistress and tell her what I want to do, because they haven't got a photography school there now. Go to their design class. First of all, invite them out here and tell them a bit about cameras and set the old cameras. But then I also want to talk to them about it. I'll put each photo in each envelope and I'll keep a register of what they are. Then the girls will select the photograph, and then before the school holidays in December, they will sit down, look at their photograph. Now, what that photograph is of a building that was in Napier. Now, that building might be destroyed now, but they can go and hunt up the address. But the building's still there. Like, a lot of them still have the name up at the top, especially at Ahuriri, where they've got those people painted on the windows. Now, they've got to go and find that building and photograph it with their cell phones and then print it off an A4. So that they've got, this is a 1930 building of a skateboard rink when they're skating on Marine Parade. Now, if they've got three kids on skates, the girl that's got that photograph has to find three of her friends and put skates on and sort of make the same picture, but now, 70 years later. And they told me they weren't interested and they would do the organising, thank you very much. And I said, "Well, I'm just going ahead and I'll have a better Art Deco than you will, because I'll have it all out of my museum." Yeah, so that's what I'm going to do. So I went to the Hastings Arts thing and saw them about it, and they said, "Yeah, that'd be great," because they have a grant. They said, "We can give you a grant to go and buy prizes." But there was just one small thing. You can't really limit it to Woodford House. You'll have to have a boys' school too. Like, what's the boys' one in Havelock North?
Harroweth.
Harroweth. Yeah, but you can't just limit it, because somebody is sure to complain if you do it like that. But I've got photos like Tiati College when it was brick building, because that's all gone now. And I've got some of the crossroads before they built the town clock and Hastings and the shops that there. You've got to find that place and photograph them. So I think that they'd go off very good. So that's what I'm planning on doing. School holidays over Christmas or something, so then they got time to get out and find the buildings. They can come and ask where this building is in Napier. But then they can photograph it with their cell phones and get a print off and redo the whole thing. Problem is, a lot of teenagers are not interested in photography now. They think it's stupid to be able to wait 3 weeks for a photograph. You only take one photograph or something, you need to take 100. Yeah. I've got two or three young ones that are really interested in it, right into it, with film cameras.
They're the ones you nurture, aren't they?
Yeah, and I've been lending them cameras. They borrow cameras off me and go out and take photos. Like this one, he was over there photographing that rusted old truck over there. He's about 18, 19. I was out there mowing the lawn. I went over and said, "What are you doing?" So I said, "Oh, using a film camera." And he says, "Yeah, I like want to get the colours and the shadows and everything else." And I said, "Oh, are you interested in photography?" He said, "Yeah, but only film stuff." I said, "Come into my museum and I'll show you through here." So that was about 6 weeks ago. Now he comes out every Saturday and he's really interested and he buys cameras. Last Saturday, or the Saturday before, he said, "I'm doing portraits." I said, "Oh, who have you got for a portrait?" He said, "I've got the chief mongrel mob from Hastings. I've got the head one that's covered in all those stupid tattoos. And I've got this war picked out. I've got to go and meet him at 11 o'clock on Saturday morning. I've got this white wall." He said, "I'm going to photograph this guy showing off all his tattoos." And he did. He made a really excellent job of it. And apparently the mongrel mob guy was really good with him and everything. He wanted to pose and everything. The house that he was living in was somewhere down past the old woman's restroom in Hastings, somewhere down that road, he said he went. And the guy was really, really good with him. He said, "I just walked up to him in the street. I said, could I photograph your tattoos?" Yeah. So I'm going to go and see the Woodford House and one of the boys' schools and see if they might not want to do it. They might have tried two or three to get him to do it.
Who are you seeing at the schools? Is it the art teacher or the principal?
Well, I've got to see the principal first to see if she approves of it. Why I picked Woodford was because when I was doing the wedding cards, I had quite a few weddings up there. And she got to know me quite well. Because when they got rid of the microscopes and the science class closed down, she gave me all the microscopes in the museum. So that's why I picked Woodford out. Because there's Iona too. I can go to Iona. I did them both, but I haven't got enough photographs of buildings. I've only got about 40 or 50. With that big book, there's some early photos of the bars. Well, I can photograph those from my cell phone and then enlarge them up to 5x7, that sort of stuff.
Right. Colin, I'd like to thank you very much for giving Carol and I your time this morning. We really appreciate it and wish you all the very best with your future endeavours, whatever they might be.
Oh, yes. Well, that's very good. Yep.